This is The Literary Life. I'm Mitchell Kaplan. I've owned Books and Books and been a bookseller for over 35 years. What you're about to hear are conversations about all things literary, with writers, readers, publishers, old friends, new friends, and anyone who might wander into our store with an interesting story to tell about their connection to books, reading, or writing. These will be informal, over the backyard fence kind of conversations, the kind I and booksellers everywhere have each and every day. Welcome, everyone, to The Literary Life. I'm Mitchell Kaplan, and my guest today is Ellis Coase. Ellis is the author of a dozen books on issues of national and international concern, including the best-selling The Rage of a Privileged Class. He also wrote a novel called The Best Defense, and he's got a new book out called Democracy, If We Can Keep It. It's the definitive history of the American Civil Liberties Union. And it's not very often, as he and I were talking before, that an author has two books out in 1 year, particularly in the year of the pandemic. His new book that we'll be talking about today is called The Short Life and Curious Death of Free Speech in America. Ellis is a Chicago native, and he holds a master's degree in science, technology, and public policy from GW University, and he currently lives in New York City. But he began his career with the Chicago Sun-Times. He was a columnist, editor, and national correspondent. He's also been a contributor and press critic for Time magazine, CEO of the Institute for Journalism Education, and is a chief writer on management and workplace issues for USA Today, as well as being a member of its editorial board of the Detroit Free Press. He's held fellowships at the Gannett Center for Media Studies at Columbia, the University of California, the National Research Council, and other very prestigious institutions. He's also been a columnist and contributing editor for Newsweek magazine for the last 17 years, while also being the former chairman of the editorial board and editorial page, editor of the New York Daily News. Ellis has done it all, I can tell. He's appeared on a range of national and international news programs, including Dateline, ABC News, and Good Morning America. I first met Ellis a number of years ago when he was a guest at the Miami Book Fair, I believe, and it was it's great to reconnect with him now. So welcome, Ellis Coase, to A Literary Life. It's great to have you here.
Thank you so much, Mitch, and delighted to be with you.
As we talked about before, we live in kind of treacherous times, and this book that you've written on free speech comes at a particularly unique time for all of us in the bookselling industry, because this happens to be the week that we celebrate banned books. And after reading your book, it really puts this week in a very interesting perspective for me. During Banned Books Week, Ellis, I don't know if you're aware of it, but we in the bookselling community and the library community, we kind of sound the warning that we shouldn't be taking our ability to read whatever we want for granted. And the way we do that is highlight the thousands of books that have been banned in this country alone by governmental agencies, by school districts, in all kinds of different ways. So given that background, I'd like to start our discussion on the short life and curious death of free speech in America by having you read something that really struck me in your acknowledgments. And it, I think, speaks a little bit to where you're heading with this very complex, interesting analysis of free speech. Ellis, would you read that for us?
As a lifelong journalist, I've always had a special reverence for the First Amendment and for the essential and prominent role it assigned the press. Like many journalists, I had taken New York Times versus Sullivan as something close to sacred text. The 1964 Supreme Court decision had slapped down Southern segregationists out to destroy the civil rights movement and along with it, the free American press. With that decision, I assumed the high court had forever ensured the nation's free press will protect vulnerable Americans from the tyranny of powerful interests. I was wrong. During my stint As writer in residence for the ACLU, I had plenty of time to think through the many ways in which I was wrong.
Well, that's what I'd like to discuss with you a little bit today, if I could. Ellis, tell us a little bit, you know, tell us a lot, you know, about the theory of the book and how you found yourself to come to understand that you were wrong about your initial concept of understanding free speech.
Sure. And let me just begin to talk a little bit about why I even wrote the book in the first place and how it came about, because I hadn't set out originally to write a book on free speech. As you mentioned, I did do a book, which was published a few months ago, which was a history of the ACLU, going back to 1920, or actually to 1915, and its evolution into the civil liberties organization it ultimately became and is to this day. And as part of the research for that, I found myself reading a lot of First Amendment cases and a lot of cases which speak to and shed light on the issue of free speech. And I ended up getting very much wrapped up in the whole philosophy behind free speech. So a couple of things. One is that I decided, as I sort of stepped back, that doing a book on free speech, I was a separate task than doing a book on the ACLU. That doing a book on the ACLU was doing a book on 100 years of American history, basically, and as seen from the context of a particular organization. Whereas taking a hard look at free speech was meant looking at some very hard contemporary issues, it meant looking at some very not well-known historical issues as well. And the first thing I'll start with, which is the title, which is the Short Life and Curious Death of Free Speech in America. So why do I talk about short life since we've had the First Amendment, you know, almost as long as we've had the country itself? One of the things that I realized as I got further and as I actually even began the research was that the First Amendment is not as old as we think it is, at least not in a way that we think that we think of it. I mean, yes, it was ratified by the states in 1791 and has been part of the Constitution ever since then. But shortly after 1791, in 1798, we had the Alien and Sedition Acts, which basically tossed out the First Amendment in the sort of aftermath of the Revolutionary War that was going on in France, you know, and the fear of many people in the United States that foreign ideas and foreign immigrants and foreigners would endanger the U.S. And the then party in power, the Federalists, essentially passed these acts, which made it illegal to speak out against the government, and specifically to speak out against Federalist officials. And so less than a decade after we passed the First Amendment, we basically tossed it in the garbage. And it took us a long time to retrieve it from the garbage. That's point number one. You know, point number two is that even as originally passed by the Congress and ratified by the states, the First Amendment did not apply to the states. Madison had made a strong argument for it to apply to the states, but he was voted down and it didn't apply to the states. And so you had the situation through all of the 1800s where, or at least up until the time of the Civil War, where Southern states outlawed abolitionist literature, talking about banned books, where we had banned posters and banned newspapers because they could not publish these things in the South. You could be arrested, your newspaper could be demolished, you could be flogged if you were disobeying these things. That didn't really change, or at least the fact that the First Amendment was not beholden, the states were not beholden to respect the First Amendment, didn't change until the 1920s. And it changed largely, it grew out of a decision called Gitwick v. New York, which was a decision that revolved around a couple of men who were self-declared communists who had published in their newspaper a manifesto, which was an advertisement. They claimed they weren't even aware that it was being published in the newspapers. But published in the newspapers, a manifesto, which called for the overthrow, not necessarily violent overthrow, but called for a new form of government in the United States. They were convicted under a form of a sedition act, and they went to a series of courts, including up, all the way up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said, okay, we'll let this conviction stand. But by the way, the law they were convicted under was a state law. They said, but by the way, I mean, even though we think these acts are egregious enough that we're going to let this law stand, states should have to be beholden under the First Amendment as well. And so they incorporated it via the Due Process Clause, and that's a lot of legal talk we don't need to get into. But essentially, they incorporated the First Amendment into a protection from the states as well.
Is that where there was that great, you talk about the Louis Brandeis dissent, right?
Right.
Where he writes about that.
Yeah, well, there were a couple of Brandeis opinions, you know, and at one point, and usually joined by Oliver Wendell Holmes, you know, where he articulates a philosophy of free speech. He did it in the Gitwick case, and he did it in a case a couple of years after that, a case called Whitney v. California, which was an important case. Again, it revolved around, this time, a communist who was a woman, a socialite from the Bay Area in California, who had decided to become a socialist and then a communist. And she was very much a modern woman of the time. She was a suffragette. She was for, you know, equal rights for Negroes, as they were called then, et cetera. But in becoming a communist, she ran afoul of, again, one of these laws. They had a lot of state laws back then. You know, they called them criminal syndicate laws, and basically made it illegal to join the Communist Party or other parties that they thought were inclined to overthrow the U.S. government. So her case went before the Supreme Court. It started out in lower courts. She was convicted in California through after several years. In 1927, it gets to the Supreme Court. Well, there, Supreme Court agreed with the decision, including actually Brandeis and Holmes. They both agreed with that decision. But they also added to their concurrence a lot of language justifying free speech, you know, saying that, you know, the framers were not afraid of free speech. The framers had free speech specifically as a way to protect us against bad ideas, against bad governance. And they articulated a philosophy that in essence said that in the long run, good ideas will run out, bad ideas, that the truth will prevail. And made one of the most eloquent defenses of free speech that has been written to this day, which led a lot of people to wonder, well, then why in the hell did they agree with the decision to convict this woman? But go figure. But they did.
Complexity of the legal system, right?
But I think complexity of their way of thinking and their fear that even within the context of free speech as they were defining it, there was some possibility that advocating governmental overthrow was not right, which is another issue about how free speech has always been confined in one way or another. But the intellectual framework that Brandeis and Marshall sort of outlined there is the intellectual framework that advocates of free speech took up and have been working from ever since then.
Well, it's the intellectual framework. When I read it in your book, I realized that is what I grew up thinking. You
right.
know, that you talk about how free speech would be able to expose falsehoods and fallacies, that free speech would be able to avert evil by the processes of education. Those are all of the things, those are all of the, quote, really wonderful aspects of free speech.
Exactly.
And what your book has done for me is it put it into a context that I never really saw before. And I think that is really the, that's really what you go on to explain, all of the intricacies and fallacies, and dangers in just blindly accepting that notion.
Well, one thing I realize is that it's a very naive notion. I mean, right. It's a beautiful notion, and it would be great if, in fact, it were true. it would be great that if once people were told the truth, they would reject the lie. It would be great if once people were exposed to facts, they would reject things that are not facts. But in myriad ways and in a thousand different circumstances, we've come to discover that that's simply not true. And we now live in an era of so-called alternative facts, where we have many people who are spreading things that are anything but the truth, and they get accepted as the truth. And I love
the way, I mean, you say that the framers of the Constitution had really no way of understanding Facebook and Twitter and, you know, all of that, the kind of alternate realities that so many people live in, and what that does in terms of chipping away at the Brandeis notion of exposing falsehoods and fallacies. Instead, it acts as an echo chamber for falsehoods and fantasies.
And also, Brandeis and Holmes, you know, like all of us, were creatures of their time. And in their time, the biggest advocates for free speech were progressives. And they were fighting for free speech because, you know, that was the era of the Palmer raids, where the attorney general had thousands of people arrested, essentially because they were foreigners and they were associated with bad ideas. It was an era in which we had prosecutions right out of World War I, the most famous one perhaps being of the union members of the IWW who were prosecuted for and convicted of and jailed and fined, you know, for advocating against the war. I mean, we've had a case, one of my favorite cases in this context, of a guy who made a movie called Spirit of 76, which he thought was a nice patriotic movie about, you know, was centered on the time of the American Revolution. But of course, the British were the bad guys. And he portrayed them as such. And by World War I, of course, the British were our allies. And you could not do that without running afoul of the law. So he got a 10-year sentence for making that movie. And so the people who were really advocating for free speech were advocating from the left and from the progressive wing. And they were, I mean, we went through terrible union fights in 1919. The steel unions, the miners, the police unions in Boston, the dock workers in California, sure. All these big union battles that occurred in 1919, which were basically violently repressed in some cases by the forces of capitalism, you know, and people were arrested and imprisoned often because they were articulating unpopular views. And so the idea then became, you know, free speech is, of course, the weapon of the progressive wing.
Right.
And we now flash forward to the current era. And what we have learned before we even get into the whole issue of technology, you know, is that it can also be a weapon for anyone. It can be a weapon. And I think one of the more interesting cases that sort of set the predicate for where we are now came in the presidential race of 2004, where you had John Kerry, you know, running against Bush, and there was a swift voting of John Kerry.
Swift voters, right?
And basically, Kerry, who was a war hero, whatever you think of the Vietnam War, he performed heroically in it, even though he later rejected it. He got medals for that. And a group of political operatives decided to portray him as something very different than that. They claimed his medals were unearned. They basically took a war hero and turned him into something close to a war criminal. And he haplessly stood by because he had never seen anything like this before. And in large measure, that's probably why he lost the election. So you had the speech weaponized in that way to an extent that we hadn't quite seen before. And I think that sort of was the predicate for the current era, where pretty much anything goes.
Would you agree that the Citizens United case, which brought all of this money into the, you know, it basically said that corporations should be treated as people, and that they were able to be involved in political speech by spending huge amounts of money. Mm-hmm. was that this is...
Oh, it's part of the rubric. Absolutely. I mean, the Citizens United, as you correctly point out, I mean, it overturned the McCain-Feingold Act, which is an attempt to limit the amount of money that organized groups, corporations, and other entities to put into political campaigns. And it tried to do this by setting, you know, one, amounts, and two, by not allowing contributions to be made very close to the election at certain times. And the Supreme Court threw all this out. And they basically said, look, corporations are persons. As persons, they have rights. And essentially made what to many people would seem to be a sort of absurd argument, that a corporation has the same rights as you and I do to be heard, and that their speech cannot be suppressed, you know, and that the amounts of money that these institutions can pour into political races should not be limited, although there were certain restrictions put on them that were easy to get around. And as a result, I mean, even John Paul Stevens, who was then on the court and resigned, I think, that same year, even he spoke out strongly against this. I mean, he had an eloquent dissent to that. Well, he basically said, this is ridiculous. He said, wait a minute. First of all, the founders didn't even think about corporations, because for the most part, corporations didn't exist back in 1787. I mean, the few corporations that did were specifically chartered by the states and licensed to do certain things that were fairly limited. And the idea that an entity that doesn't have the right to vote, that doesn't die, that may not even consist of U.S. citizens, you know, should have the same speech rights as U.S. citizens is a little bit ridiculous. But of course,
in essence, it's the co-opting of the argument. It's the co-opting of the progressive argument of free speech in order to assert a moneyed approach to dominating the conversation one way or another.
Oh, very much so. I mean, I write about that also in the context of Facebook and Zuckerberg's defense.
That's a wonderful piece where he completely misconstrues Sullivan, and he misconstrues so much. And I mean, you really do a wonderful job of dissecting all of that in the book.
Well, thank you. And he subsequently, just a couple of weeks ago, announced some revisions in their policy, which still don't quite get it right, but at least it makes it more different than what it was. But what I found particularly offensive about Zuckerman's argument was that it was in defense of the right of politicians to run ads that were totally based in lies.
Completely deceptive,
transparent lies that were obvious lies. And rooted in conspiracy theory and other things of that nature. And his argument for why he thought that was okay was a First Amendment argument. And he said, well, you know, Sullivan v. New York Times, the revered decision from 1964, he said that's what that was about. You know, in that decision, you also had a case where there was an entity that was using misinformation, and the Supreme Court basically decided that political speech that had to be allowed. And what I argue, and I think anyone who understands that case would argue, is that Zuckerberg totally misconstrues what that case was about. It was not about organizations spreading misinformation. It was rooted in the civil rights movement of the early 1960s. It was brought, and the people who were sued principally, now, we're not just the New York Times. It was a group of ministers who were allied with Martin Luther King and were fighting to get funding for their struggle. And they were trying to explain their struggle to the readers. So they took out a full-page ad. And in the context of that ad, they talk about the arrests that King had been subject to and the physical abuse and other things that students protesting segregation had been subject to. And they ended up misstating the precise number of times that King had been arrested, and some other similar errors that were made in their recitation of events, which were seized upon by the officials of Alabama to say, including the police chief there, who said, well, I've been libeled. And of course, the Alabama courts went along with them. And they awarded a settlement in a libel suit that was unprecedented for the time, which was $500,000. And then there were other state officials who had suits pending that would have been in the millions of dollars had they been won. And Alabama was, of course, going to give them their way because they wanted, first of all, to kill the civil rights movement, and they wanted, secondly, to destroy the Yankee press that was down there covering it. So that was what the Supreme Court was confronted with in 1964 when they looked at this jumble of events, and they came to the very logical conclusion that no, officials in Alabama shouldn't be able to hide behind libel laws and a few innocent errors to totally bankrupt the movement and destroy the newspaper industry. And therefore, they set a certain standard where you had to exhibit what they called actual malice, which is to say that you knowingly printed falsehoods, but not just falsehoods, but material falsehoods that were important. And so somehow Zuckerberg got it all turned around to anybody who printed anything that was not totally true was doing the same thing that political advertisements that were totally fabricated were doing.
Well, and you see where that's led us, you know, today. I mean, that is exactly, there's a straight line to that argument, which is now being co-opted by everyone on the right to allow all kinds of misinformation to get out there.
And what we've come, oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, what we've come to see is that the freedom to speak does not mean all that much if you don't have the ability to speak. You know, and having the ability to speak these days in the political context generally means having access to TV or access to large amounts of money to purchase ads and to propagate political speech. So what we've done is that we've given a huge advantage by allowing this huge flood of money into politics by those who have money. And what
through corporations and Citizens United and all of that. Absolutely.
Exactly. And we certainly know that politicians are much more likely to pay attention to people who give them millions of dollars than they are to people who don't.
Most definitely. You're in a very unique place to talk about the following, because you wrote this thing about the ACLU, the history of the ACLU. And there are always two things that, I mean, stuck in my mind has always been that, and maybe this is, you know, one of those progressive views about the sanctity of the First Amendment, or maybe it's misguided. But when you talk about the Skokie marches of the Nazis
right. Coming
to Skokie and the ACLU defending it, and the same thing with the ACLU defending what went on in Charlottesville and the internal angst that created. Can you speak to that a little bit in the
sure. Context
of what we're talking about?
And that position, the ACLU position, that it defends the right to speak, not the content per se of speech, is an old position for them. I mean, they wrote a pamphlet back in the 1930s when Nazism was on the rise in Germany. And the title of the pamphlet was something along the lines of, you know, why do we defend Nazis? And the argument they made then was essentially that if we get in the business of trying to distinguish exactly what kind of speech we are going to defend, and then where do we draw the line? And wherever we draw the line, it can have harmful effects on the people we want to represent, because they may not be able to rise to that particular benchmark. And so flash forward to 1977, 1978, when a Nazi-allied group wanted to march in Skokie, Illinois, which was a suburb of Chicago, and which was then home to a fairly large population of Holocaust survivors. And Skokie was outraged that people wearing Nazi regalia and shouting Nazi slogans would want to march in Skokie, which of course was what the Nazi group wanted to provoke, and pass ordinances that would have made it impossible for them to hold that march. And the group then went to the ACLU in Illinois, and they said, well, will you help us with this? Knowing full well that the ACLU had his position, and the ACLU did decide to defend them. And they won. They prevailed in court in that decision, and went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And it caused shudders throughout the whole organization, because even though that position was uncontroversial for people within the ACLU. It was very controversial for people outside the ACLU, particularly for many members of the Jewish community who said, wait a minute, why in the hell are you defending these awful, awful people? And who threatened to withdraw funding, who threatened to basically punish the ACLU in whichever way they could. And the ACLU leadership said, what in the hell are we going to do with all of this? How can we get our perspective out? And they finally decided to have an attorney, the attorney on the case, a guy named David Goldberger, who was Jewish himself, to write a letter explaining why it was that he took this case. And he rose to the challenge and, with the help of others, put together this letter that became the most successful fundraising letter that they had done up to that date. And what he said was quite simple. He said, look, I'm Jewish. I don't like these Nazis any better than anybody else. In fact, I refuse to even capitalize the word Nazi in this letter. He said, but I'm also defending civil rights workers in Selma. He said, and the very arguments that the city government in Skokie wants to use against these people is being used in Selma to try to block civil rights workers. And in order to help the people in Selma, I need to be consistent. I need to make the same argument about these kinds of laws if they're going to stand up to scrutiny by the courts. It was an argument that many people found persuasive, and it, as I said, became the most successful fundraising effort in history. So now we flash forward to 2017, and there's a similar case, and this time it's in Charlottesville with this group called itself Unite the Right, which is another sort of neo-Nazi, white supremacist type organization. And they wanted the right to hold a march in this park, which it used to be Robert E. Lee Park. They were renaming the park to Emancipation Park. They were going to take the statue of Robert E. Lee, who, of course, was a Confederate war hero. They were going to take this down. And that made some people angry because they were going to do that. So these some people decided to hold a big march to protest this and to protest the whole movement against their heroes from the Confederacy. And it was also an effort to just unite nationally, all these right-wing forces that were opposed to basically just white supremacist forces. And the city said, okay, we understand you got First Amendment rights, so we'll let you have your march, but we won't let you have it in what was then referred to as Lee Park. You got to have it somewhere a little bit further out, from the center of town, where that'd be easier for the police to monitor and protect people, and where it's less likely to cause havoc. And the ACLU took them to court, along with another organization, a local organization that was also there. And the court found in behalf of the organization, which was that they to move them would violate their free speech rights. And so they were allowed to schedule the march where they originally wanted it. Well, the march never actually took place. I mean, what happened, is that the morning of the march, or even before the night before the march, they marched into the University of Virginia, which is in Charlottesville, and they raised havoc and got into a fist fight, and that was broken up. And then the day of the march itself, there was, and Virginia is also an open carry state, so a lot of these people have weapons. They show up in weapons and regalia, and it was such an ugly scene, and the portents of violence were so apparent that the cops basically declared it an illegal assembly and said, this thing can't go on. We have to. But in the aftermath of that, even though the event itself never occurred, a young man who was a Nazi, for whom Adolf Hitler was a hero, plunged his car into a number of people, so he can kill in a young woman. And so that happened, and also there were two policemen who died who were monitoring the march because their helicopter crashed. And so you have three deaths as a result of this, and one that was an outright murder, basically. And also you had close to 20 people injured by the same guy running in his automobile into them. And it caused a crisis within the ACLU, partly because the ACLU is a different organization now than it was in 1978. It did not have a racial justice segment in 1978. It did not have any minority staff to really speak of, back in 1978. They had a very small number of African Americans and other ethnic minorities working for them. And the country was in a different place than then. I mean, we did not have a president who was openly supporting white supremacists back then. So the whole dynamic was it changed. And a lot of these people said, why in the world, within the ACLU, why in the world are we defending people like this? And that was a question that had not really been raised inside the ACLU back in 1978. And the ACLU had to grapple with it and spent months with meetings and arguments back and forth. And the question of whether they should change their policies, and ultimately decided that in large measure they weren't going to change their policies, that they were going to still, look at content, but they did say that they set up a procedure by which to review the cases they were taking, and they also just said we absolutely are not going to defend people, who are carrying weapons and who seem inclined towards violence.
Well, that's a wonderful explanation of all of that, and. You actually, I don't know if it's there or somewhere else, you quote Marantz as saying that unchecked speech can expose us to real risks as well. And
right.
That's part of the complexity of free speech too.
Well, that's what makes it very complicated now, because the danger of the government trying to abolish the First Amendment is not very high. But what we've discovered is that we have all of this speech that flows out from, it seems, everywhere, and then that surfaces on the internet, and it surfaces on Facebook and various websites where people propagate hate, where people encourage other folks to organize. Just the other day we saw this debate about the Proud Boys. Well, one of the ways they organize is over the internet. They use the internet and they find like-minded people, and they decide they're going to all assemble together in Portland or whatever other city that they decide they're going to assemble.
They got a huge boost from this last debate as well.
Right. And they got a nod from our commander in chief. And so I think a lot of people who have been free speech absolutists and still are, by some definition, are saying, well, wait a minute, we have to get a handle on this somehow. And if we're not going to have the government censor, which most thinking people don't want to do, then how are we going to handle this, this huge problem of this outflowing of bile and rage and stuff that can really create havoc in society? And
you speak to that, and that's what I want to get to as well, is to some of the solutions of this. And you speak to it very eloquently in the book. You know, your whole idea of that we need to educate people in terms of how to really understand what's factual and how to understand when they're bombarded by this information, how to filter it out.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've done a very poor job on several things. I mean, one, we've done a very poor job in terms of educating people on critical thinking, and there's a lot of research, and I quote some of it, researchers at Stanford, who took college students and high school students and exposed them to some of this nonsense on the web, but also gave them the tools to get to the truth, which is very easy in many instances, where they could see that these were this was, quote, really fake news, or that this was manufactured events and whatnot. And overwhelmingly, the students chose not to do that, not to check it out. They just accepted as given what was there. And I think that's a throwback in a sense. I mean, our reading, particularly when we got what we thought was news, if it came from any sort of reputable source in the past, had been edited and had been checked by somebody who we sort of trusted. All this stuff that comes at you on the web, there's no telling where it comes from. There's no telling even what country it comes from. And we haven't taught people how to look through that and just not accept something because there's this idea, well, in the same way, well, it was in the newspaper, it must be right. Well, it was on the internet, so of course it's right. And a lot of what's on the internet is absolute nonsense. And I think a lot of what's on the internet is absolute propaganda. And we're not really equipped to deal with that. But we also seem to be very hesitant as a society to look to self-policing methods. I mean, and I think that Zuckerberg and Facebook is a good example of that. There's nothing at all in the First Amendment which says that a private organization that handles, that publishes information is forbidden to check the veracity of some of the information that it checks, and is forbidden to have rules that speak to a certain kind of decency. There's nothing at all in First Amendment jurisprudence that would stop that. But also, even the very idea, and I want to make it very clear, I'm not advocating any kind of government crackdown and censorship, but the very idea that free speech has ever been unregulated is based in ignorance. There have always been limits on speech in this country and elsewhere, and our limits have tended to be things like pornography and particularly child pornography that we place strict limits on. But obviously also things like libel we put limits on. And going back to, at the very least, 1942, when we had a famous case, the Chaplinsky case, which had to do with a Jehovah's Witness, who was arrested by a cop because the cop hadn't protected him in I guess proselytizing on the street, and he was getting abused, and so then he ends up calling the cop a fascist, and the cop ends up arresting him for calling him a name, and the Supreme Court upholds this arrest. And they basically came up with this theory they called fighting words, which were that if you say things that are so provocative and so obviously off base, then people are going to get angry with you, and their anger is probably justified. So you're in the wrong when you do that. Well, that doctrine has sort of fallen into disuse, as far as I know. It was never explicitly overruled. But we no longer really subscribe to it. But it wasn't until, 1969, where we had this Supreme Court case that they basically decided, the Supreme Court basically decided that hate speech was okay. I mean, or at least that it was not forbidden by the U.S. Constitution. That was in a case involving some KKK folks from in Ohio. So you have you've always had at least some provisions that regulate some kinds of speech. And so the question that I pose is that as a society, we really need to think about this issue, and we need to really sort of sort through how we're going to protect ourselves, and at the same time allow speech that is essential and that is useful and that is just our right to have.
Well, and I think during Banned Books Week, we all can agree that no matter what complexity there is in this in the notion of free speech, that advocating the banning of any books is a really bad, bad thing.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I don't think anyone who considers themselves a fan of free speech or the First Amendment
would advocate any.
Exactly.
You know, what's really interesting, there's a wonderful quote on your book by Everett Dennis, who talks about your book. He was at the Medill School in Northwestern. And he says about your book, he says, "This compelling narrative guides its readers toward an understanding of the complex twists and turns of free speech in America." I think that really sums up what your book is. I think it's a brilliant analysis of where we are today and looking at the difficulties in applying much of what we used to apply when we were thinking of free speech to the complexities of our day today. I mean, you devote a whole chapter to what's happening on college campuses. We can't go through all that now, but
right.
Just the complexity of what's happening on college campuses is quite remarkable. Not to mentioning, what's happening with the way, we're still fighting the fight around, the moneyed having, as you said before, the greatest access to being able to express yourself. Because what good is free expression if you don't have the means to express yourself in that
sense? Yeah. And the whole purpose for free speech, to go to sort of complete the circle, the whole point of having it was that it's supposed to make us a better democracy.
Right.
You know, and so the real question that we face as a society is, what can we do at this point to first save our democracy and two, to make it better, I think.
And it's a wonderful way that we can segue into what are two very distinct challenges facing us right now, which is we have a political challenge and we have a cultural and social challenge at the same time. And and they're all coming together at once while we also are in the middle of this pandemic, which is a health challenge in the same way, which exposes a lot of these issues that you've been writing about and talking about. Ellis Coase, I could talk to you forever. This has been really, really wonderful, and I thank you for it. And would you end by maybe reading a little bit of part of that introduction of your book,
sure,
which I found so fascinating?
Okay, this is from the introduction, as you say. No one expected their words to be enlightening or their tone harmonious. Hatred rarely comes in such flavors. It spills out as an ugly, incoherent mess infused with the rotten odor of willful ignorance. And so it was with the Nazi wannabes, sessed-out white supremacists determined to make their mark on the world, committed to convincing anyone who might listen that their superiority was both evident and inevitable. The setting was downtown Charlottesville, Virginia, August 2017. Their mission was unity of like-minded hate-mongers. Their leader, Jason Kessler, was a 33-year-old who lived with his parents and at once supported Barack Obama. He had learned that many demographers thought whites would eventually become a minority race in the United States. That news was so unsettling that Kessler remade himself into a white rights activist. It's one thing to have immigration, but to the point where they overwhelm the host population is not right, he said. He styled himself as a civil rights and human rights advocate, focused on the Caucasian demographic in the mode of Jesus Christ and Mahatma Gandhi. His Unite the Right rally, observed the Christian Science Monitor, was supposed to be the movement's coming out party, an emergence from the shadows of internet chat rooms into the national spotlight. And then that sort of sets the groundwork for why Charlottesville and the Charlottesville incident came about and what happened before that unfortunate murder of the young woman.
Well, Ellis, thank you so much for joining me on The Literary Life. The book is The Short Life and Curious Death of Free Speech in America. You can buy it at Books and Books. You can buy it through your local indie bookstore or through bookshop.org. You can listen to Ellis. He's coming up. If you're hearing this in the month of October, he'll be at the Miami Book Fair virtually in November. And I know what I'm going to do after reading this. I'm going to run out and make sure that I read Democracy If We Can Keep It, which is the ACLU's 100-year fight for rights in America. Ellis, you've done all of us a great service. Thank you so much for being part of this.
Thank you, Mitch. It was great being with you.